mercy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. We have one prophet.
Yes.
You know, and that's a beautiful thing. We take it for granted. We really do take it for granted.
Exactly.
But actually, there's one original source for the foundational principles of our religion. And so we're united in our love for the Holy Prophet. And then we come to Imam Ali alayhi salam as well. Many Shi'as would immediately assume that, no, this is something that divides us. And it's very easy to look at the negative part of it, especially when we're into studying these minute details. It often makes us think that, wait, there's so much that differentiates us. And in some sense, yeah, definitely there is. But in the same way, let's look at the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam. For us as Shi'as, he is the first of the 12 Imams, the successor of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. And, you know, there is nobody in between that.
Yes.
Because Rasulullah.
And infallible.
Ali. And infallible. He's ma'asum.
Yes.
Immaculate. You know, he never committed a sin. And all of those different things. Then we come to the Sunnis. For them also, Imam Ali alayhi salam, they say, karramallahu wajha. May Allah exalt his face. May there be grace
elevate
upon
his soul.
Yeah. So they have an esteemed vision of what Ali alayhi salam was as well. And for them as well, he's the fourth khalif, you know, the fourth and final khalif. So even from their perspective, there's no really no escaping from the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
All right. I want to add on to some things that might unite us as well, such as Baytullah al-Haram.
And
the pilgrimage to Hajj during the Hajj Mosem or during the Hajj season.
Right.
That's something that brings Muslims together. Also the fasting of the month of Ramadan.
Very good.
These obligations also, you know, bring us together. You know, and especially for those living in the West, it doesn't matter what sect you are from the Islamic sect, as long as you are during the month of Ramadan, you're looking at your brother in faith and humanity, also thirsty and hungry, looking at a non-Muslim eating a hamburger or drinking his Pepsi and cola during the hot summer day. So then you look at him and then you just like, okay, there's some people, there's someone with me that is also going through the same pain that I'm going. And that just unites the Ummah together.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Brother Habib. Let's take a break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We are here talking about culture and what makes Muslim culture different from others' cultures.
If we take an example like Hajj, the Kaaba is sacred for Sunni, Shi'as, doesn't matter.
Right.
If you're a Muslim, the Kaaba is your Qibla. But then when it comes to the Hajj, there are details in how to tie the ihram, for example, the cloth. You know, the white cloth that we wear.
The rituals differ from the rituals.
In those rituals, we have slight differences in them. If we focus on them, yes, certainly. Yeah. There would be differences. But actually, the entire principle of the Hajj, we both have it.
When you look at the skeleton, the basics, the pillars, they are the same, right? Or similar, at least. But when you're talking about the details, as you mentioned, they are minute, tiny, all right? So, Brother Habib, what is the common ground among all Muslims?
The sources of bringing our laws, sources of ma'rifah, the sources of knowledge that we have, is also very important. Because every action we do really returns to our knowledge, really returns to our intellect. And therefore, the Qur'an is, I think, the base of unity. If we have the Qur'an, well, everything that we stated really just goes back to this. Us, both of us, believing in the Qur'an. And it's what brings us together. It's the you could say the...
The pivot.
Yeah. That's a good word, right? It's what makes a Muslim a Muslim. Believing in the Qur'an. Believing what's in the Qur'an and all the rulings in it and making it a source, a reference, returning to it in the time of need. And, of course, the saying of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, إِنِّي تَارِكُمْ فِيكُمْ الثَّقَلَيْنِ كِتَابُ اللَّهُ وَعَتْرَةِ أَهْلِ الْبَيْتِ أَهْلِ الْبَيْتِ I'm leaving with you or after me to the two heavy things. The Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhum assalam. Really, just looking at Muslims, everything that they do, everything that they go, they return to the Quran. They reference to the Quran. Even the hijab. Why does she wear hijab? Mm. The Quran stated. Why do we do Hajj? It's an obligation that we understand from the Quran. Why do we have? Why do we even study? Why do we have manuscripts? Because the Quran emphasized our knowledge. It's really all of it going back to the Holy Quran. I think that the base, the skeleton that you said, my brother, I think it's the Quran. What really unites Muslims is the Quran.
Well, you talked about the theoretical aspect, right? But what about the deeds? Like, for example, fasting that you mentioned for the month of Ramadan, or even the pilgrimage to Hajj.
Yeah.
Right. These are the rituals that we do, like on a special days, and that makes us really different from, I mean, the Muslim community is different from non-Muslim communities.
True.
But what other rituals and acts and actions would you consider to make Muslims different from non-Muslims that they are not doing at all?
Saying salamu alaikum.
Like salamu alaikum. Exactly. The greeting. Yes, exactly. Like, I've heard a lot about, like, the way, the Western people, like, the non-Muslim, I'm talking about them, specifically speaking, when they greet, they usually use words such as, hey, hi.
Hello.
It doesn't make any sense.
Hello has actually no meaning. I've just found this out recently. Hello actually has a fulul, a completely irrelevant
meaning. It's just like a greeting.
But
unlike salamu alaikum, where it means peace be upon you.
Goodbye. That fascinated me. Goodbye.
Yes. It comes from like Khuda Hafiz. It has the same meaning of Khuda Hafiz. Like, God be with you.
Yeah. It actually came from God be with you.
With you, exactly.
And now it's changed into goodbye. They've forgotten what it means. But
what about the clothes, the way we wear? The way the Muslims wear. Is it, or does it make it, or make them different from
I don't think
non-Muslims?
So.
No, me too. I don't think so. You know why? Because trends. Everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like before I remember in the, like in TV shows and, you know, I've read books about the 1800s in the United States. It was very, very, very rude for a woman to show her ankle.
Mm-hmm.
To show her ankle.
I see.
It was considered rude. Now, if you don't show your ankle, it's considered rude. These are traditions. These are customs made by communities and societies. It changes. And therefore, you cannot say that it's something that distinguishes us. Yes, in periods of times, it might distinguish us because we follow the modesty code line or guidelines and codes and rules that the Quran brought, returning us to the Quran again, which makes it the skeleton of
that. Brother Muzaffar, I'm talking about, like, when I talk about clothes, what about the strange color, strange style? Do we see that quite often among Muslim youth, for example?
Strange colors?
Yes, strange styles of...
The thing is, we do see those kinds of things among the Muslim youths. Because there's lots of different cultures in the West. Culture where they wear really baggy clothes. For a Muslim youth growing up in that kind of an environment, he just chooses which one of these
looks
groups,
cool. Yeah, which trending. What is his friends wearing? Peer pressure comes in as well.
And then you just follow that. So obviously, it's going to be a little bit different for sisters growing up in the West because they're going to wear hijab regardless. But for boys, no, I don't think so. If they're into sports, they're going to wear shorts.
Just stay with us.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
One of the other things, Brother Habib, let me ask you this question. One of the other things that I've noticed when I was communicating and mingling with Muslim friends as well as non-Muslim friends, this is my own experience. I think this is something which is of course, there has to be a series of research conducted, or has to be the research conducted by scholars and the like, all right? But I think, to the best of my knowledge, that there is more peace and quiet among Muslims. Like, people, like, they feel more comfortable when they have this religion. And, you know, because they base their things, like what you said, we have one source, right, to go to return to, like the Quran. And it tells us, for example, we have come from this origin and we are going to go this way, and if you are a good person, we're going to go like to heaven, and then the rest of the story, right? So, but we don't see that kind of peace among, mentally speaking, among non-Muslims. Don't you agree?
I'm actually working on the pistachio theory. And there's one thing that I see when people come and talk about those motivators, those therapy sessions that they go, people who think about suicide a lot.
Yes. And like the group therapy.
Yeah, the group therapies and stuff like that. The first thing that I notice that they always do is that they always try to imply that you have a purpose in life.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Mm. Because they don't have Jannah and Nar.
Yes.
They don't have hell and fire. Unlike Muslims, they believe this attitude has, of course, if they have knowledge in the religion and the yes. Quran, like how you said.
And if they act.
Yeah, and they act upon it, of course. Yes. They know their purpose in life. They know that this life is not the goal. They know that it's not a goal. And that yes. is why we see famous people, actors, athletes, think about suicide after achieving great things in their sports or in their fields. Why? Because when they reach it, they see emptiness.
Mm. Exactly.
So I think that, yes, we do have this kind of, you know, that depression, that mental illness, the suicidal thoughts
yes.
are low. And if they are available, I've actually tracked them down, you know, mm-hmm. with the small society that I live in. I've noticed that that when they understand the religion better, it goes away.
Thank you very much, Brother Habib, and thank you very much, Brother Zafar. Joining us here in the studio, talking about culture in the program Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The funeral prayers for one of the 8 members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the 8 were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'in, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.
They killed about 8 people, which we are sure that now, as they used to do normally, after they kill, they will carry the dead body away. So also, the same thing yesterday, they carried away the dead bodies. 8. It is only one of our Muslim brothers by name Shamsuddin Abdurrahman we were able to take away from them.
The Nigerian police have denied that any member was killed during what they described as a provocative trek. Press TV visited a health facility where many injured victims of the attack were receiving treatment from bullet wounds. Members of the Islamic movement have continued to express outrage at the persistent attacks by security forces whenever they come out for religious events.
The security agent in Nigeria, they have been paid. They paid their salary and they provide them with weapons to protect the life and properties of the citizens. But in these days, they are using these weapons to attack the citizens that they are supposed to protect. Our offense to the government of this country is just coming out to show, to practice our religion the way we understand it.
In a statement, Amnesty International has expressed grave concern over the murder of the 8 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. It called on the Nigerian authorities to put an end to the deadly crackdown on members of the Islamic movement, which it says has been going on since December 2015. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Presidents of Russia and Turkey held their face-to-face talks since the beginning of pandemic. After the talks, the two leaders confirmed that the mutual ties developed positively despite some problems.
Our negotiations are not always easy, but with a positive final result, our departments have learned compromises that are beneficial to both sides.
Syria was among the main topics of talks between the two leaders. In Syria, Russia serves as the main supporter of the Syrian government, while Turkey backs anti-government groups. Despite this, the two countries have been cooperating in seeking a political solution in the country.
Peace in the Syrian region depends on Turkish-Russian relations. Our joint steps on the Syrian issue are of great importance. The steps we have already taken were correct and cannot be changed.
Last year, Turkey and Russia reached a ceasefire agreement to put an end to war in Syria's Idlib. Turkey is concerned that an escalation of violence in northern Syria may lead to a new influx of refugees across its borders.
The two sides have to make a balanced relation when it comes to Syria, but it is not an easy task amid plots by the US and its allies. For example, the US did not object to the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Syria through the territory controlled by the Syrian troops, and this was done with an attempt to knock Russia and Turkey head on.
The talks between Erdogan and Putin came after U.S. President Joe Biden refused to grant a one-on-one meeting with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly.
Another pressing issue in Russian-Turkish cooperation is Ankara's purchase of Russian S-400 missile systems. On the eve of his visit to Sochi, Erdogan told reporters that he rejects any foreign pressure regarding this issue and intends to go ahead with his decision to the system. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are living here in this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July. Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs. Therefore, he asks for implementation of a transparent supporting plan for people like himself and the rest of vulnerable Afghans who are suffering from hunger and malnutrition.
Humanitarian aid should be distributed among the neediest families like us, but so far, we have seen that most of those who are in charge of handing out humanitarian assistance are corrupt figures because they usually distribute the aid among their own relatives and friends.
Under such circumstances, the Taliban administration has also called on the international community and humanitarian aid agencies to resume their aid supplies to Afghanistan. This comes as some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, like Iran and Pakistan, have begun sending humanitarian aid to Kabul, a move that is widely welcomed by both the Taliban and ordinary Afghans, especially the internally displaced ones.
A rise in the number of internally displaced people has put pressure on Afghanistan. Moreover, Afghans are already denied access to their assets, as Washington has frozen them under the name of slapping sanctions on the Taliban. However, facts on the ground show that Washington's move has affected the lives of ordinary Afghans, especially internally displaced people, rather than affecting the Taliban. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide for the strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond the red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
Yemenis have condemned what the Iraqi government has described as an illegal meeting held in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The meeting demanded Baghdad join the so-called Abraham Accords and normalize ties with Israel.
We believe in the rights of the Palestinian people to liberate their land, and therefore we will stand against any attempt to normalize relations with Israel. The recent illegal meeting in the Iraqi city of Erbil is completely rejected. It's a desperate attempt after the failure of the so-called deal of the century. Palestine will be liberated and Israelis will be expelled.
Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour slammed the meeting, saying it is an attempt to drag the free people of Iraq to normalize relations with the Israeli regime, adding those who have normalized ties with Israel are part of the Zionist project in the region.
The normalization meeting that was held in Erbil, Iraq, is an attempt to drag the Iraqi people into normalization with the Israeli enemy and for Iraq to become part of the Zionist project, as some Arab rulers did last year. But the conference failed and was rejected by all the free and resistance forces in Iraq because it is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause and the Islamic nation.
The so-called Abraham Accords is a U.S.-led Middle East initiative aimed at establishing diplomatic relations and full normalization between Arab countries and the Israeli regime. This agreement was signed by Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan, and was welcomed by Israeli officials.
Yemenis have praised the Iraqi government's rejection of normalization of ties with Israel. They say the free people of the world will always support the Palestinian cause until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki is the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, known as the IMN. The top Muslim cleric and his supporters have been subject to a crackdown by Nigerian authorities over the past years. The most brutal attack took place in December 2015 in the northern city of Zaria, Kaduna State. The army opened fire on Zakzaki's supporters, killing hundreds, including three of his sons. The military accused the sheikh's supporters of having tried to stop the passing convoy of the army chief to assassinate him. The IMN vehemently denied that accusation. During the crackdown, Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife suffered gunfire wounds. They were taken into custody under the pretext of protecting them from violence in Zaria. But they were later charged with culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, and disruption of public peace, among other things. A year later, the Abuja High Court ordered their release, but the Nigerian government defied the order. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife remained in prison until July 28th this year, when they were released after a Kaduna High Court dismissed all charges against them. The IMN welcomed the ruling, saying it is a victory of perseverance in the face of extreme persecution. Kaduna state officials later acknowledged in a report that the military had acted disproportionately in connection with Sheikh Zakzaki and the Zaria massacre, and that the soldiers involved should be punished. No one has so far been prosecuted over the incident.
British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel, and but I've been trying several of them, and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really, you know. I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but another fuel.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery, because due to shortage of drivers, we couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed to tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened, like, you know. A lot of drivers have gone back home, like, and hence, there is a shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day.
The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country, so the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a three-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas, and the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. We've to clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests, so there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want to guarantee that they are not left stranded. And if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're willing to make. Amina Taylor, London.
A latest study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that difficulties in trade with the UK could put 3.6 billion euros worth of Made in Italy agri-food exports at risk. Italy's agri-food exports into the UK have already decreased by over 2% since Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed a Brexit trade deal with the EU back in December. Experts say the drop is a direct consequence of Brexit.
From January 1st, Brexit has introduced more bureaucracy, more tax, and a completely new and complex regulatory environment, which have greatly affected the trade volume between the UK and the EU. It must be said that our agri-food products have suffered a drop in trading revenue in Britain only.
The UK ranks fourth among Italy's food and beverage trading partners after Germany, France and the US. Pasta, tomato derivatives, cheese and dairy products are the main Italian export items to the UK.
Among other Italian products exported to Britain are transport, clothing, machinery and appliances, and metals. Trade volume between the two countries stood at about 35 billion euros in 2020, but due to red tape and no tariffs, many are concerned it might drop significantly in the coming months.
We knew full well that Brexit would have had serious consequences. Having said that, Italy's production system is strong. Our high-quality agri-food products are in great demand.
Coldiretti has also expressed concern over the decision by Downing Street to move away from European food standards. This way, Britain risks being flooded with cheaply produced or counterfeit food and drinks. Max Civili, Rome.
As Afghans witness their most difficult days amid the collapse of government and newly settlement of Taliban's emirate, the Islamic Republic of Iran delivers its third round of medical and food aids to Afghanistan. This Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid arrived at Kabul airport on Saturday, containing several tons of rice and other basic food products.
The plane that you see here has brought Iranian aids containing 15 tons of food products. We are here to sort out the aid supplies. We thank neighboring countries that help us in this critical situation and stand by our side after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces.
Due to bazaar shortage and increasing prices of food and medical goods, Afghans in major cities and villages demand humanitarian aids. Furthermore, they're concerned about their assets being frozen by the U.S.
We are in a critical situation. Public assets, including our salaries, have been blocked and most of us have lost our jobs. We demand neighboring countries to provide us with humanitarian aid.
Afghanistan's economy, which depends on foreign aid, suffered a big loss in the recent change of government. The people of Afghanistan look forward to receiving international aid, calling for an end to sanctions on Afghanistan as soon as possible. They believe that blocking the assets of Afghans by U.S. government puts the people under pressure rather than the Taliban. The United Nations has warned of a looming food crisis in Afghanistan. The UN has also said that its food stocks in the country could run out by the end of September, further pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A number of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers during military raids into different areas in Jenin and northwest of Al-Quds. Three Palestinians were killed near the towns of Beit Anan and Biddu northwest of Al-Quds. The Israeli military said its forces had been tracking a Hamas movement cell for several days and had conducted a wave of operations against the movement across the West Bank and killed Ahmed Zahran, Mahmoud Ahmedan, and Zakaria Badwan, all from Biddu town.
We were shocked by the martyrdom of a number of our sons. We say their blood will pave the way for the Palestinians to go ahead with their fight against the occupation. This is only one part of the Zionist violation against our people.
In the village of Burqin, southwest of Jenin, 16-year-old Yusuf Sabah was killed during the clashes and his body was confiscated by the Israeli forces. 22-year-old Osama Sabah was another Palestinian from Burqin killed by Israeli forces. He succumbed to his injuries in a hospital in the city. Palestinian Islamic Jihad later endorsed him as a group member and threatened that black days await Israel in the West Bank and its crimes will only intensify the movement's resistance and unity. Thousands took part in his funeral procession. His wedding was planned for next month, his father told us.
We received the news with utter shock and immense sadness, but no objection. It's Allah's will. Osama's wedding was supposed to be next month, but he was chosen to be martyred.
Two Israeli soldiers were seriously injured during the clashes that broke out between Palestinians and Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issued a statement backing the military's operation.
Palestinians say Israel uses lethal force to stem anti-regime resistance in the occupied territories, but they say Tel Aviv will fail to intimidate them into giving up their struggle. Muna Kandil, Occupy Jamallah.
So
September 26 marks the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian Journalists, initially declared by the International Federation of Journalists in 1996. To this end, Palestinians held a sit-in rally in front of the house of the journalist Youssef Abu Hussein, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes during the last escalation in the Gaza Strip.
Youssef has been targeted inside his home. Israeli regime intends to target journalists in an attempt to hide the truth of this inhuman regime from being delivered to the world. This is totally against international law to target civilians.
There are 24 Palestinian journalists inside Israeli jails, including a female journalist. There are also a huge number of journalists that were injured and others killed while doing their work.
Palestinian journalists and media outlets have always been a direct target of the Israeli regime. Hundreds of journalists have been killed or injured while covering the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
This is a stand to express our support and loyalty to our colleagues who have been killed or arrested by the Israeli regime for only covering the truth. This event is held to highlight that we won't allow the international community to ignore the Israeli crimes committed against journalists. During the last escalation, we lost Youssef. 35 media institutions were bombed and more than 12 journalists were injured.
Palestinians called on the international media organizations to show solidarity with Palestinian journalists and take steps to provide them with security. During the recent escalation of unrest in Gaza, the Israeli regime has intentionally targeted Palestinian journalists and destroyed several media offices in a bid to block the truth. Palestinians here call on the international community to provide protection and security for journalists and hold Israel accountable for committing atrocities against them. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
There is tension between the election-winning force, that is Boris, a one-off phenomenon, and the Conservative Party as an institution that would like to have a future in government under less capricious leadership, says Rafael Baer, columnist, in an article titled "The Boris Effect is a Symptom of Britain's Decaying Political System." Stay tuned for more. There is a growing feeling in the Conservative Party that Boris Johnson's performance as Prime Minister would be much improved by him being a bit less Boris Johnson. MPs don't express the thought in those terms. They praise their leader's winning ways with voters but regret that his agenda is unfocused. They are thankful for the boost that COVID vaccinations gave to their poll ratings but grumble that the dividend is being squandered while tough decisions go unmade. They admire Johnson's way with words but despair of the way he mismanages people. Every policy dish comes slathered in rhetorical confinement. Leveling up was the ketchup of catch-up last week, with no meat underneath. This week, there is a stew of initiatives targeting crime behavior, more tagging and CCTV. Offenders on litter-picking duty extended the stop and search. The Police Federation aggrieved over frozen pay, dismisses it as gimmickry. It will not satisfy Tory MPs' hunger for substance. They should know the menu by now. The failure of that schism to break the two-party mold is what persuaded many opponents of Jeremy Corbyn to stick with Labour even when they felt their party had been captured by dangerous fanatics. Some moderates quit on points of principle. Most sat tight and waited for the Corbynitis to recede, but the high water swept in tens of thousands of new members, with the result that Labour became in effect two parties. One for moderate social democrats and a radical socialist challenger. In continental European countries with proportional electoral systems, no one expects those two tribes to live under one roof. The same is true of the national populists and orthodox conservatives who mingle under Johnson's banner. The Tories solved their Brexit party problem by total assimilation, and some MPs argue that this is a sustainable arrangement. The Prime Minister, they say, is charting a new centre ground. He leans left on economics, borrowing money to spend on stuff voters like, and veers right on cultural values, extending the perpetual crackdown on immigration. That upsets small estate Thatcherites, fiscal hawks and social liberals, but it ticks enough boxes with the public to lock the opposition out of power for another term at least. Johnson cannot deliver strategic diligence any more than Theresa May could dazzle with a dexterous wit. It doesn't come naturally and can't be faked. The Conservative Party chose its current leader precisely because he was uninterested in the practical reality of government. May failed because he tried to get Brexit done in some meaningful, technical sense. Johnson triumphed by getting it done in the realm of pure imagination and carrying with him a lot of people who couldn't conceive of voting Tory under anyone else. There is tension between the election-winning force that is Boris and a one-off phenomena, and the Conservative Party as an institution that would like to have a future in government under less capricious leadership. It is easy to forget that there were two nationwide ballots in 2019, and the Tories were humiliated in the first one, the European parliamentary election, in which they came fifth, behind the Greens, Labour, Liberal Democrats, and in first place the Brexit Party. That was a wild result in extreme conditions, but it was hardly the first time British voters have registered an interest in breaking up the two main parties duopoly. It's already broken beyond repair in Scotland. David Cameron thought the political pendulum was swinging his way in 2010, only to find it snagged on a spike in support for the Lib Dems. Their tenacity as a third-party spoiler is itself a legacy of SDP's brief breakthrough in 1980s. Another view is that only a Boris effect glues together an improbable alliance of ex-Labour stalwarts, Shire Tories, and people who simply couldn't stomach the idea of Corbyn as Prime Minister. In that interpretation, there is no alchemy of a new centre ground and no roadmap for 21st century conservatism, just old-fashioned charisma plus luck. It is hard to know either way because allegiances have been so volatile in recent years. In the aftermath of the Brexit referendum, Leaver and Remainer identities seem to have trumped previous loyalties. Tory pro-Europeans met Labour's anti-Corbyn faction in a symmetrical centrist recoil from their respective leaders. None of the above soared in opinion polls. Whips lost control of their parties. MPs switched sides or declared themselves independent. But when it came to 2017 and 2019 general elections, first past the post and the question of who should be prime minister had their usual effect. When only two parties can credibly claim to be running candidates for number 10, votes get funneled back down the old red and blue channels. In the absence of electoral reform, there is no obvious reason why the pattern will change, and yet it is unhealthy and unstable for the country's two big parties to be sustained only by polarizing mutual animosity and a system that suffocates political startups. That is how we now have a Labour Party where admirers of Corbyn in exile cohabit with supporters of the successor who banished him. That is how we have a Conservative Prime Minister whose superpower is persuading people to overlook the fact that he is a Tory. It suits Labour and the Tories to tell people that each is the only alternative to the other. It suits them to pretend that votes cast under those conditions indicate popular support. But it insults the intelligence of everyone who held their noses in 2019 and marked the ballot paper with fists clenched in frustration at the choice on offer. There is less surface volatility now, but the deeper currents are still turbulent. The two big political brands have primacy in a failed marketplace. It is not easy to envisage what the force will be that disrupts their arrangement, but that is the nature of dramatic change. It is unimaginable right up until it happens, at which point everyone agrees that it was inevitable.
Seven, they're in a pressure.
We come to you, and oh God, name that thou art our only king.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim, on IRIB English Radio. One of the main sources of Islamic teachings is obviously the Ahadith. In the science or in the subject of Usul al-Fiqh or the principles of jurisprudence, it is studied and it said that there are four main sources of Islamic knowledge or for Islamic knowledge to be derived from. One is obviously the Holy Quran, the other is the Sunnah, which is it has its own definition in Usul al-Fiqh. But one of those things that the Sunnah includes is the Hadith and the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And therefore it is important for us to get acquainted with it, and it's also important for certain writers to structure the books of Hadith in a particular way that people, like myself, like yourself, are able to benefit from them in a manner, you know, that we can use them in our daily lives. And also in different languages, because the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, yes, originally written in Arabic. Not even written in Arabic. They were spoken Arabic, written down also then in Arabic by those who, of the companions who wrote the traditions down, or those who passed it on from, you know, heart to heart, or as they say, senior to senior, you know, verbally and orally transferred from one person to another, was all done in Arabic. But that does not mean that the teachings should remain. If it is possible for even a bit of it to be transferred into another language, it should be. Therefore, this is the book that we will be introducing to our dear listeners today. Is based upon this, that the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam being transferred to us in the language that we understand, that is the language of English. Insha'Allah, please stay tuned for our next segment.
Subhanallah walhamdulillah. La ilaha illallah wallahu akbar. You can say it once or 100 times or more. You'll feel at peace inside and it'll open every door. That's the power.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. As mentioned previously, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a book based on the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and has been ordered in a particular way. It has been ordered in a alphabetical way, that is, in a way of the Arabic alphabet, so Alif, Ba, Ta, and so on and so forth, and based upon ethical and practical teachings that me and you can benefit from and and apply in our daily lives. The book is titled Mizan al-Hikmah, or as English, a title is known as Scale of Wisdom. Some have said Scales of Wisdom, but not Scale of Wisdom. This book is or was compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri, or Ayatollah Muhammadi Ray Shahri to be exact. He was the former head of the Iranian Hajj delegate that would go, obviously, for Hajj to the holy city of Mecca. For Hajj, obviously. And he compiled this book in, first of all, in Arabic only, which was compiled in 10 volumes. This book was then translated bilingually, that is Arabic and Farsi, Arabic and Persian, in 15 volumes. After this translation, the book was then condensed. Right? It was abridged. So basically only the important hadith from each section were taken out. So for example, if a section contained 10 ahadith, 3 were taken out, 4 were taken out and then placed. And then this was also then translated with the Persian with it in 1 or 2 volumes depending on the print. This condensed version, this abridged version, was what was used in order to be translated into English. And this is what the book that we have with us today is, the translation of this abridged version. This book was translated by a group of translators which included people such as Zaid al-Salami, Abbas Virji and others, and was published by 2 publishing institutes. One in the Islamic Republic of Iran, that is Darul Hadith Publications, and the other one, the Islamic College of Advanced Studies in London. The difference between the two publications is this, is that just the paper used by the Islamic College of London is a lot better than the paper used by Darul Hadith. But the contents are exactly the same. There is no difference in the contents of these 2 books. So, inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a small part of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. Inshallah, please stay tuned.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio, where in this episode we have been discussing the book Mizan al-Hikmah, which has been compiled by Ayatollah Muhammadi Reishahri. Now, the digital version contains an introduction that is a lesser of an introduction that is contained in the original printed book. The original printed book contains a much larger introduction that also goes through some of the history of hadith compilation, and so on and so forth, but very briefly. So we'll be reading a bit of this introduction, and obviously we will not be reading the text of the thing, because in another show, a hadith of the day, many of the traditions have been quoted from Mizan al-Hikmah. So in the introduction, it is written that the great collections of Shi'ite traditions, hadith, have for a long time been organized in a topical manner. That is, they've been organized in terms of their subject matter, in terms of their topics. So, example, one deals with salah or and prayers, one deals with fasting or sawm, and so on and so forth. The organization of these collections has been influenced by the nature of requirements, as well as the personal and social problems of the time of the compilers of these books. So what may be, you know, brought as an example is the book Man La Yahdhur Al-Faqih of Sheikh Saduq, who at that particular time compiled this book as a Tawzi' al-Masail, or what we would call a Tawzi' al-Masail, a book of practical acts, in which a person who wants to know the duty at that time will refer to this book of hadith. So it is compiled in a manner where people will be able to, for example, want to know their duty when it comes to salah or prayer or fasting or hajj or khums or zakat. They will refer to this book and the hadith that can be found under it. So this is one example that can be given with regards to this phrase. Another influence was the need to assign topics to these collections and insert entries congruent with the intellectual concern of the scholars, both advocates and opponents. Therefore, the emergence of new queries and questions in any era necessitates the publication of new books. Indeed, Mizan al-Hikmah is one of such answers. The present work is the outcome of new ideas in the fifth and sixth decades of the present century, which, based on the requirements of the time, is not only a collection of hadith concerning morals and ethics, even though it includes them. The work, besides providing answers to the needs of its time in different fields, responds to various questions, problems, and doubts, philosophical and those related to the mode of conduct of the true leaders of Islam, based on the ontological teachings of the household of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Inshallah, that concludes our reading from the book Mizan al-Hikmah. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.